Bonsoir, good evening. I'd like to ask everyone to take your seats. We'll start in a moment. Just give you a few minutes to find your seats, those who are coming in. Please join us. Good evening, bonsoir. My name is Rosie Goldstein. I'm the Vice Principal, Research and International Relations here at McGill. L'Université McGill serait heureuse d'accueillir nos collègues, la communauté des étudiants et anciens étudiants de McGill et les membres du public à la conférence commémorative BD, un événement annuel très cher à l'Université McGill. It's my great pleasure to welcome you once again to the annual BD Memorial Lecture, the 2014 BD Memorial Lecture, taking place once again during McGill's homecoming celebration. Let me take the time to welcome all our alumni, welcome back, and welcome to homecoming weekend. The BD Memorial Lecture dates back to 1952, when McGill was fortunate to receive a donation of $100,000 from Dr. Henry Beatty. He gave this generous donation to establish a public lecture in honor of his brother, Sir Edward Beatty, who was the first Canadian-born president of CPR, Canadian Pacific Railway. McGill was a logical home for this donation and the initiative of this public Beatty lecture, as Sir Edward had served McGill as Chancellor and Chair of the Board of Governors for over two decades. From the beginning, the Beatty Memorial Lecture Series was intended to bring top thinkers, innovators, and leaders to the university in the service of advancing scholarship both at McGill and in the broader Montreal community. In the history of the BD Memorial Lecture Series, we have hosted a celebrated group of public intellectuals and leaders, including Muhammad Yunus, Queen Noor of Jordan, Deepak Chopra, and Arthur Ashe, among others. Tonight, we are thrilled to welcome Dr. Carl Dizeroff, whose work is revolutionizing research on the function of neural circuits and systems. Our principal, Professor Suzanne Forche, will in a few moments introduce the professor in more detail, outlining what he's going to talk to us about tonight. But meanwhile, I'll take a moment to introduce Professor Suzanne Forche herself. It's my pleasure to introduce our 17th Chancellor, Vice Chancellor and Principal, Professor Suzanne Forche. And just a few words, Professor Forche is a, I'll have to go back, won't I? I'm unfolding your talk. There we go. Sorry, back. And now I will not touch the keyboard, and I will introduce Professor Suzanne Forche. She is an accomplished scientist in her own right, a crystallographer, and proud double alumna of McGill. She began her five-year term as McGill's 17th principal and vice chancellor just over a year ago. Since that time, she has set a clear course for McGill, emphasizing openness to new ideas and connectedness to local and global communities. I'm certain that tonight's lecture will be an excellent example of such new ideas and how McGill, under her leadership, is connecting to our communities. Prior to her appointment, Professor Forche was president of the National Natural Science and Engineering Research Council of Canada, or NSERC. McGill is extremely fortunate to have Professor Forche at our helm, putting her experience and expertise to work, sustaining and developing the myriad world-class research programs at McGill. Please join me in welcoming Professor Forche to say a few words. Thank you.
Bonsoir et bienvenue à cette présentation ce soir qui s'insère à l'intérieur de notre fin de semaine de retrouvailles à McGill, une fin de semaine où les anciens de McGill se réunissent pour se rappeler de très bons souvenirs de leur passage chez nous et puis pour aussi pouvoir profiter de tout ce qui se fait aujourd'hui à McGill. As you know, this is our homecoming weekend. It's a great, great time of the year where we welcome past students to our campus. As Dr. Goldstein said, I've been back to my alma mater for a year now, and it has been a full year of homecoming for me. And I can tell you I have really, really enjoyed it. I am really thrilled to introduce our speaker today who's going to help us look at our brain and illuminate our brain. our 2014 BD Memorial Lecture, Dr. Carl Dicer-Roth, is the D.H. Chan Professor of Bioengineering and of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University. In addition to his renowned contributions to teaching and research, Professor Dicer-Roth serves as the Director of Undergraduate Education in Bioengineering and leads an optogenetics training facility at Stanford. He is also a practicing psychiatrist at Stanford with a specialization in affective disorders and autism spectrum disease. Great research, as we know, starts with curious mind, and he is such an outstanding example of that statement. Minds that are open to challenging conventional wisdom. Professor Dicer-Roth has pushed the boundaries of knowledge with the development of groundbreaking methods and technologies in neuroscience. In 2005, he attracted international attention for the development of optogenetics. This revolutionary technique allows for the optical stimulation of specific classes of nerve cells, engineered in a way that makes them sensitive to light. The importance of optogenetics as a research tool continues to grow rapidly, and the applications of this technology has already improved our understanding of psychiatric disease. Stunning the neuroscience community again in 2013, Professor Dicer-Roth, together with Dr. Quan Hum Chong, introduced a method for viewing the brain's complicated circuitry like we never were able to do before. Clarity, and that's the name of this technology, makes biological tissue, such as mammalian brains, translucent and accessible to molecular probes. This technology has been heralded as one of the most important advances to emerge from the scientific community in decades. Clarity is already helping scientists extract significant new information about how brain networks function and has shed light on clinical disorders such as autism. Professor Dicer-Roth is very generous with his expertise, which he has contributed to many community and scientific organizations. And it is a great pleasure, in fact, it is a thrill for us to welcome him to McGill as the 2014 BT Memorial Lecture. Please welcome with me our guest speaker. Merci.
Okay, thank you very much. Merci. It's a great honor for me to be here, and I hope I can share some of the excitement that we have together developed in our laboratory to help illuminate neural circuitry. I'm a psychiatrist. I have a particular interest in depression and in autism spectrum disease, and I'll try to share some of those clinical stories with you as well to help clarify the urgency of the need, the depth of our ignorance, and also the thrill of the moment, how it seems as though we've turned a corner and can finally make the sort of progress that we've long dreamed of. Now, the basic domain in which we work is we work with animals. We work with freely moving rats and mice, sometimes with monkeys, and it's very important that this work carry on this way. But I also see patients no more than one day a week, but it's an important part of what I do. This epidemiology is not always fully appreciated. The depth of the suffering of psychiatric disease, both worldwide and in the Americas, as represented by the red pie slices in these numbers from the United Nations, is not always fully appreciated. The red pie slices here correspond to psychiatric disease, and if you look at the fraction that's due of years of life lost to disability. It's very, very high, higher than most people think for psychiatry. And this is partly due to the fact that psychiatric diseases are very chronic. They're often fatal. They're hard to treat and very poorly understood. And we lack basic ways of quantifying or observing what really the core problem is. And I'll give you an example. So autism is very common, perhaps getting more common, but certainly being recognized and diagnosed more effectively now. In severe cases, it is extremely debilitating. People who suffer from this disorder cannot communicate, have difficulty engaging in social interaction, often are overcome by stereotyped and repetitive behaviors, a very devastating disorder. I see some of these patients in my clinic, and they, if they're on the more high-functioning end of the spectrum, you can talk with them. And it's very interesting to try to understand how thoughts are moving in their brain and try to gain some intuition or insight into that. One common feature of autism is very poor eye contact. It's a really striking thing. Many of you might have seen this. Many people in the engineering department where I work actually do that normally, the professors, and it's not uncommon. But in the severe cases, it's really striking. You cannot make contact for more than a fleeting second with individuals on this spectrum. And then the eyes dart away to the wall, to the floor very quickly. And it almost looks as if it's fearful, but with the high-functioning individuals, you can actually talk to them about this, and it's very interesting. So I have a patient who's on this end of the spectrum, and I asked him after working with him for a couple of years, I wanted to see if it really was, you know, fear-provoking. And so I asked him one day, what does it feel like when you do make eye contact? Does it make you anxious or fearful? And he said, no. And I asked, well, is it overwhelming? And he said, yes. That seemed to resonate with him. And then classic psychiatrist, if you don't know what else to say, you just say, tell me more. And very often, that actually does lead, often there is something more to say. And he said, when I'm looking at you and talking, if your face changes, then I have to think about what that means and how I should react to that and change what I'm saying, and that overloads the rest. So very interesting. It's an overload. And I asked if there was too much information, and he said, yes, if I'm looking away, it's easier. Now, this is a conversation. It's just words. This is basically what we have in psychiatry. It's interesting, no doubt, but it's not like a lab test, a blood test measuring your hematocrit. It's not something that you can readily compare in large populations, and so psychiatry has a long way to go, but at the same time, you have to put this in the context of the magnitude of the suffering and the epidemiology. So we're trying to make some headway. The human brain is incredibly intricate. There are probably more than 80 billion neurons in this forebrain region, which each of those neurons will have more than 10,000 synapses or connections with other neurons. And, of course, you can't always do every sort of observation that you would like in the human brain. So we start with animals, and we've been able to make some headway. And I'll share with you different domains, all using optical tools to look into the brain and see it at very high resolution, even at the level of single cells flashing on and off as they carry out their jobs, electrical current pulses, driving fluorescent signals. We can also fly into the brain, the intact brain, and see the fine structure, the arrangement of cells and wiring. And we can start to play in activity into animals that are freely moving, activity through fiber optics that can turn up or down very precise connections and cells in the brain. And this is the sort of opportunity we have, and bringing these together all at once is, I think, really driving and helping to drive a lot of the excitement around neuroscience. What really has helped kick off part of this excitement, the optogenetics side, which you heard mentioned earlier, is some unlikely friends, microbial organisms, single-celled algae, and archaebacteria. They live in unusual places in some cases. The archaebacteria live in salt lakes in Egypt that have very high sodium chloride concentration. The single-celled algae on the other side, these are effectively pond scum. They live in freshwater ponds. And it would be hard to predict that these would help us make headway in understanding neural circuitry in psychiatric disease. But the reason that works is they make light-sensitive regulators of electrical current. And they do that, of course, for their own reasons. They are motivated to move ions, which is electrical current, for energy purposes. The algae need to sense light to get to the right level for photosynthesis. And the way they do this is with single proteins called microbial opsins. The opsin is this protein. It's encoded by a single gene. It's a single protein. It lives in the surface of a cell, which these blue circles represent. And some of these opsins respond to blue light and let positive ions into cells. Others respond to yellow light and let negative ions into cells. Fortuitously, these exist, and positive ions coming in happens to be neural code for on or active. If you drive positive ions into cells, you will typically cause those neurons to fire action potentials, which are the currency of information flow in the brain. Likewise, negative ions coming in will tend to inhibit neural firing. So what we did initially was to take these genes and put them into neurons. And to use the fact that they were genes and use genetic tricks to put them only into some cells and not other cells, so that we could then flash light onto these tissues and get only the cells that we wanted, that we had introduced the genes into, to respond. And we called optogenetics, a name put forward in a paper we wrote in 2006. Now, optogenetics became particularly interesting once it worked not only in a petri dish, but once it worked in a freely moving animal. And what's shown here is a measure of anxiety in a mouse. Now, if you look at this mouse behave, it's a little bit of a sped-up movie. It's not actually moving that fast, but I sped it up to actually give you enough information in a short talk. You can see the mouse is mostly spending its time on the periphery. It's not going into the center, and that's very smart for a mouse. Its apprehension in the absence of immediate threat, being in the center, being in an exposed area, is very bad if you're a mouse. And so this is anxiety, and it responds, the behavior changes with anti-anxiety medication. Now the light has been turned on, and I'll tell you what was happening. For the first time, the mouse is willing to cross into the center of the arena, still exploring everything, sides, corners, not changing its speed, but perfectly willing to include the middle of the arena as something that it would like to explore, as well as the periphery. And then we turn the light off, and what we find is the animal actually reverts back to how it was before. Now, what is the light? This was an experiment carried out with my postdoctoral fellow Kay Tai in the laboratory. And what we did, we had light playing in through a fiber optic that was able to activate a specific connection from one part of the brain to another that we thought might regulate anxiety, and it actually turned down this anxiety behavior. And that was an experiment that you could never do with an electrode, which cannot distinguish different kinds of cells and connections within our brain region. But the optogenetic principle allowed us to just make one connection sensitive to light. We could then come to a deeper understanding of the circuits that regulate anxiety. And so that was in 2011. We've done a number of other interesting things. I'll give you a couple highlights, and then I'll get into depth on a depression-related experiment. But I'll tell you, we've done work on Parkinsonism. Some of you might know that this is a disease associated with loss of dopamine neurons. It can be treated with medications, but those stop working after a while. And then deep brain stimulation can be done, where an electrode is placed and used to target a deep structure, typically called the subthalamic nucleus. And you can stimulate that very powerfully with the electrode, but it doesn't work for many people, and it only works for some symptoms, and it stops working after a while. And so we'd like to understand how deep brain stimulation works better. It's just an electrode, but maybe some of how it's not working as well as we'd like has to do with the fact that it is an electrode. It's not hitting just the right kind of element. It's being nonspecific as a non-optogenetic method would be. And we were able to find that there are incoming connections into the subthalamic nucleus that are the likely reasons why deep brain stimulation works in Parkinsonism. We have Parkinsonian animals that can barely move. They have these very slow movements, as this path tracing shows, over a minute. And that's a classic feature of Parkinsonism, is slow movement or bradykinesia. But when we used optogenetics to control incoming connections, incoming wires coming into the subthalamic nucleus, these Parkinsonian animals could move freely again. And that was a reversible effect. When we turned off the light, they went back to where they were. So it's helped us understand deep brain stimulation relevant to Parkinsonism. But I want to get into a little depth on a depression-related question. Depression is very common. It's one of my clinical interests. I see patients with autism, but also treatment-resistant depression is something else that I focus on. Now, depression is a complex disorder. It's got multiple features to it. There are symptoms that relate to poor sleep and appetite. There are poor concentration. There are agitation or psychomotor symptoms, as we say. There's depressed mood, often hopelessness and suicidality. And these are very diverse, but each of them is debilitating in its own way. Now, how on earth could you study something like this in an animal? Well, one doesn't really know what the animal's experiencing, but the animal reports with its behavior what it's willing to do. And one thing you can do is a non-painful test that indicates to you how much the animal is willing to put forth effort to correct a situation. So a challenging situation which requires motivated behavior, effort, and this is something that in depression is very much lost. In fact, even relatively minor things can seem overwhelming or are overwhelming in the depressed case. So we can take rats or mice, and we can put them in a cylinder of water, and they swim. And they swim very well, and even if they're not swimming, they float. So they're not in danger in any way, nor is it painful. But they do want to get out of the water, and so they swim for a while. And after a while, they transition to a state, once they've more or less found their efforts to be futile, where they no longer swim at all, but they're simply floating in the water. And this is a very interesting transition for an organism to go through. A challenging situation, initial effort, transition to a more passive coping state where a decision has been made at some level that it's not worth effort, the probability of success is low enough that it's not worth ongoing effort. That's an interesting enough thing in itself. You don't even have to think of it as relevant to depression. That's a pretty interesting thing for an organism to do, a very consequential decision that must be made. But an interesting thing about this test, we can study it for its own sake in that context, but we can also ask, if you give an animal chronic stress of the kind that might cause depression or exacerbate depression in a person, what happens? And very interesting, you'll find that these animals will much more quickly transition to that immobile, hopeless-like state if they've been chronically stressed for a while. And if you give them antidepressants, it will correct that state. Okay, and that has raised a lot of interest in this as a test that's relevant to at least one symptom domain of depression. And so we've taken this, and we've taken it to the next level. We've plugged in more things and gotten a lot more information. And you can see we can have a fiber optic in place where we can play in patterns of activity to particular kinds of cells during this complex behavior. And think about that. Potentially interesting. To determine, excuse me, the causal neural circuitry that's involved in this transition to the immobile or hopeless-like state and the emergence from it. We can also record, we can listen in on the local cells that are present and see what they're doing during all this, and then we can use very high-resolution measures of behavior. We can put a little magnet around the hind paw of the animal and a coil around the cylinder that picks up the movement of every kick the animal makes, and so we can see with millisecond resolution every movement the animal makes, record from the neurons, and play in patterns of activity all during this very interesting behavior relevant to depression but also interesting in itself. And we can pick out the neurons using electrical techniques and be sure that we're recording from many neurons at once. And I'm going to show you a few slides about these results because they're so interesting. The first thing is, what happens when you're just listening to neurons in the brain during this test? What are they doing? And so one question you might ask is, where are you going to go to listen in? The brain is big, and there's a lot of complexity. And we went to the front part of the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex, initially. Why did we go there? That's a part of the brain that's typically associated with setting up and executing complex, long-term plans of action. It's the executive center of the brain in many respects. And when it's damaged, as in a stroke, for example, you can also see depressive-related symptoms arising. So we think this is an interesting place to look for these behavioral patterns that require an assessment, a look into the future, an assessment of the value of action and making a plan to go forward. But of course, there are many brain regions you could listen in on. But we saw extremely interesting cells when we were recording, listening in during this test. And so the movement, I've shown you the magnet, and we can pick up every kick the animal makes. That's shown in black. And black is the representation of movement. The red is the spiking or the electrical activity in a neuron. It's the activity of a neuron in prefrontal cortex. And there's three phases here. There's before the swim test, during the swim test, and after the swim test. You can see the animal's not moving much before the swim test. It's relaxing in its home cage, not moving much, but a lot of the neurons in this front part of the brain are very active. So they're not general movement-related neurons. They're doing something, even though the animal is barely moving at all. Is it thinking? Is it feeling? Is it planning? Nobody knows. But they're active, and the animal's not moving much. But then when you put it in the swim test, and by the way, notice this 60-second time scale here, and you can see right here before your eyes is this transition to that immobile or hopeless-like state over a few minutes. The movement stops. It moves into a more or less immobile state, which is often called a hopeless-like state in the literature. But now this neuron in prefrontal cortex, it encodes or represents just those moments of action, the moments when the animal is exerting vigorous effort to meet the challenge of its situation. And you can see that here. The neuron is active all through only when the animal is exerting this behavioral pattern. And then you can put it back in its home cage and it reverts back to how it was before. So it's not a movement neuron, but it's a neuron that's active when the animal is carrying out a motor pattern to meet a challenge. Now, that's interesting. Nobody had ever made that sort of observation before, and it required a lot of engineering of the test, but it still was unsatisfying because it was just a correlation. It didn't tell us what was causally involved. We could see some behavior. We could see this activity in this very interesting cell. It looked very, very intriguing, but you don't know what's causing what or if there's any actual relationship. And that's the real value of optogenetics. You can come in then and ask these causal questions. What's causing what? And so Melissa Warden in the laboratory came in and said, I'm going to test that. And so she introduced one of these optogenetic tools, these microbial opsins, the excitatory one, the one that lets positive ions into the cell in response to blue light, and that's called a channel rhodopsin, CHR. And she introduced that into the prefrontal cortex and put a fiber optic in there too. And we were very excited. We're going to see what happened. And she quantified the kick frequency, the escape behavior of the animal as a function of time, and all the blue bars here, that's when she's driving the light, and she alternated on and off periods as a good comparison. And she saw absolutely nothing. There was no effect on the behavior. You can see this transition over time to the more immobile state, and it didn't matter that she was driving or not with her light. So very disappointing. She tried this multiple times. Then we had an idea. Maybe there's just too much complexity in prefrontal cortex. Maybe we need to be even more refined about the kind of cell we're controlling. There are different cells that do different things, even oppositional things, in every area of the brain. And for this, we were able to use a technique of projection targeting. Every neuron sends out connections to the next neuron downstream. And you can do what Melissa did first, which is to have some neurons expressing, making these opsins deep in the brain, and you can bring in a fiber optic in that brain region. But you can do a twist on that, a separate kind of thing. You can put your fiber optic somewhere else in the brain, entirely somewhere else. And because these opsins fill the cell, they're at the cell body, They're at the dendrites where information comes in. They're on the axon where the information goes out. They'll fill the whole cell and make the whole cell light sensitive, no matter where it is. By putting your fiber optic in some other brain region, you're getting just the cells that send connections down there. The only thing that's sensitive to light here are axons coming from cells that live here and are going out to this brain region here. And this principle, we used that in the anxiety movie that I showed you, and that was in 2011. That was the first control of behavior by regulation of a specific projection. And since then, and I reviewed this recently, it's been used, you don't have to read this, but it's a great many of different number of different studies using projection targeting to control behaviors relevant to anxiety and depression. And so we thought, well, what could we do? And this had been, you know, in 2011 we had the anxiety paper. We also were able to, in separate studies, to control dopamine neurons, and so we had some confidence in that. This is a very interesting study. The dopamine neurons that are lost in some diseases, they live in the midbrain, and one of the places they live is an area called the ventral tegmental area, an area deep in the brainstem. And those dopamine neurons send projections to many different places in the brain, and they're very complex. And we found, you know, a lot of people had wondered, well, in cases where dopamine neurons are lost or inhibited, very often there are depression-like symptoms. Patients with Parkinsonism will often be very depressed as well. It's a very important comorbidity. And this plus other efforts, including wonderful work done here at McGill, has implicated dopamine neurons in reward and the feelings of pleasure and hedonia. And we were able to, in animals, test this. We were able to control dopamine neurons that lived in the ventral tegmental area and see if animals would work hard to get bursts of light coming into the ventral tegmental area, just working for light. And they will. You can set things up so if they poke their nose, if they do a nose poke into a particular little hole in their cage, and you give them a burst of light through a fiber optic to the dopamine neurons, they will work very hard for that. They will do thousands of nose pokes per day in order to get that little burst of light to their dopamine neurons. That really shows you that it's a real reward value, of positive conditioning value for the animal in this task. But there's great complexity there, and we did a twist on that. We said, okay, we're not just going to control those cells. We're going to put the fiber optic downstream in another structure and see if we can implicate cells that live in region A and send connections to region B. And we did that over here, cells that live in this deep brainstem structure and send their axons to the nucleus accumbens, which is an area that's very tightly associated with the site of drug action like cocaine and heroin. And we found animals would work very hard for that projection. So an even more refined definition of the kind of cell that's of interest, cells that live in the VTA and project to the accumbens. So Melissa said, okay, let's take this principle, this projection targeting principle, and let's apply this to this depression task. Instead of just getting everything that lives in the prefrontal cortex and not seeing anything at all, maybe we've got to be smarter. Let's express the opsins in prefrontal cortex, but let's put our fiber optic in a bunch of different other places downstream. One of the places she looked was where serotonin neurons live, the dorsal raphe nucleus, DRN. And as you know, many antidepressants do include actions on serotonin as a neurotransmitter, and so that was a reasonable place to look. She looked many other places too. But what happens if you drive the cells that live in prefrontal, where executive action and long-range plans are made, and they project to the dorsal raphe nucleus where serotonin neurons live? Well, there she saw something completely different. Every time she drove those cells with light, the animals exerted more vigorous behavior to try to escape from this situation. It was reversible, and it kept going all the way through the test. And she did control experiments to show it wasn't a non-specific effect of just movement. It didn't rev up speed or anything like that in a regular open field like I showed you before. So they were specific to this challenge task. And she found another region that promoted the hopeless-like state, did the complete opposite, a projection from prefrontal that goes to a structure called the lateral habenula. And so it seems that, and you can see that here, every time she drove the projection, there was a decrease in the animal's vigorous escape-related behaviors. So there are different cells in the front parts of mammalian brains, some that promote the vigorous exertion of effort to overcome challenge, and others that actually deter it. And they project and can be defined and identified as such by where they send their connections to. And you know it's not just correlation anymore. You know they're causally involved because you yourself are playing in a pattern of activity to those cells. And this is the sort of excitement that we have. We can now look at, you know, you look at depression, you look at the great complexity of the symptoms and their variability and the challenges we have in quantifying them. And you put that in the context of the great clinical need, and there's this great frustration but great hope that having this sort of causal understanding of which circuits, which connections actually control which behaviors and symptom domain related behaviors is driving a great deal of vigorous effort among the scientists as well. You can also take things away. You can provide activity, but you can also take it away. We made optogenetic inhibitors that move chloride ions, negative ions, into cells to quiet them down. And we were able to address interesting questions like which cells in this nucleus accumbens, this reward-related area where drugs of abuse are thought to act, which of them are important or necessary for the rewarding actions of cocaine. And drug dependence and abuse are extremely thorny problems, very hard to treat, permanently for sure, and really in many ways hijack very vast swaths of the brain, at least as represented in behavior of human beings. And we found that we could turn down a very small population of cells that lived in the nucleus accumbens, a very tiny population of cells called the cholinergic cells that make a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. And we could eliminate the positive conditioning, the rewarding effects of cocaine by turning down just 1% of the cells in this one brain region optogenetically. Now, how do you know if the animal is experiencing reward from cocaine? This is another interesting test, and it shows the flexibility of these behavioral assays that we have. Now, if you just look at this lower graph here, the red tracing shows the movement of an animal. And you can see there's more, the animal appears to spend more time, more of its movement is in this chamber than that chamber. Now, why is that? This is an animal that previously received cocaine in that chamber. And it's a recognizable chamber. It's got some features to its walls and floor that the animal can recognize and remember. In this chamber, it got through the same mechanism. It just got a little salt water. And it remembers that. It likes to spend time in the chamber where it received cocaine. And that's a normal behavior for the animal. And what we found, if we turn down this 1%, this very highly defined population of cells in the nucleus accumbens, we could make that response disappear. And the animal no longer cared that it had received cocaine in one chamber. And this was a consistent effect over many animals. So something as powerful as the rewarding effect of cocaine can be inhibited by just turning down a very tiny population of cells that's well-defined in one brain structure. That's another example of this sort of opportunity, and it comes from the inhibitory side, complementing the excitatory side. And this was work led by Alana Witten in our laboratory, who's now an assistant professor at Princeton. Melissa Warden, who did the 4-SWIM test, is now an assistant professor at Cornell. Now, there's also great opportunity in the immense diversity of the microbial opsins that are out there. Our first experiments and our first introduction of fiber optics in work led by a couple people, Feng Zhang in my laboratory and Antoine Adamantidis, a very talented postdoctoral fellow who spent some time here at McGill. They engage in some very innovative efforts introducing channel rhodopsin into deep brain structures and controlling behavior. But there are so many more complex things you could do now with playing in multiple kinds of activity. There are different opsins that respond to different colors of light. So what if you were able to see how two populations compete with each other, or three populations even? And for that, we go to nature and we see what's out there. And every major kingdom of life, whether it be algae or fungi or bacteria, they have these microbial opsins, these incredibly efficient, compact, single-gene receivers for light and regulators of ion flow. And we've done work with genome institutes, people sequencing algal genomes to find new opsins which have shifted colors that control their action. We've also done a step further. We've been engineering those opsins that we found. We've been mutating them to give them new properties. And you can only do that if you have some idea of what it looks like, what the structure is like. And in biochemistry, you can achieve very high-resolution structures that are called X-ray crystal structures that let you really see the shape of the protein. And you can see this is channel rhodopsin. It's two paired monomers that come together in a dimer. Each of those monomers has seven components that go through the membrane of the cell. So those are called seven transmembrane proteins. And if you turn them on their end, you can see a little hole. This is the channel through which ions flow. So we were able to go in there and make mutations and re-engineer the channel. I won't have time to tell you about that, but we could turn channel rhodopsin from a regulator of positive ion flow into a regulator of negative ion flow. And that's the sort of engineering that we were able to do. I want to share with you a link to the art world now. One of my graduate students, Emily Ferenzi, who clearly her brain works in amazing ways, she was familiar with this work. Some of you might know from Kandinsky, Yellow, Red, Blue, from his Bauhaus period, as I found on Wikipedia. It's a very, she knew this, I didn't know it, but it's a very interesting piece of work, and when she saw this, she thought about optogenetics and microbial opsins, and she painted what became the cover of Nature Methods Journal, a homage, as it were, to Kandinsky. And if you go back and forth, you can actually see the depth of her insight. Here is a seven transmembrane, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, microbial opsin that she painted in her cover of this journal where her paper appeared. Here's a neuron with an electrode in it and all kinds of other complexities. Now go back to the Kandinsky painting, and you can see here's this seven transmembrane thing, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So I don't know, and there's the pipette in the cell. When I look at it now, I can't see anything but optogenetics now. So I guess it's art imitating life. So that's the optogenetic side of things. I want to share with you one other thing, which has to do with observing the structure and the activity, seeing what's going on. And that's very valuable. It's nice to control it, but you also want to see what's normally going on. You want to see what the animal, how the animal is normally using its circuitry. We saw a little bit of that with the recording in prefrontal cortex. We saw those single neurons. We were listening in on them. They were very interesting. But if you just have an electrode in there and it's poked in and you're seeing these little blips on your computer, that's interesting, but that's about as far as it can go. You can't get much more information about those cells. You can't see what kind of cell it is, where it sends its connections. That's kind of the end of the road. And what's particularly exciting now is we've been able to use new optical techniques, techniques developed in our lab and alongside techniques developed in other laboratories, all together in an integrated way, to actually see activity along projections that are defined anatomically, so we can see how the animal is normally sending activity traffic along different connections. And to do this, we also like to have a lot more detail on the connections themselves, and that has been a challenge because the brain is incredibly complex and it's very hard to see deep into it without cutting it into many thin sections. Now, why is that? This is something I found on the internet. I can't take any credit for it, but I thought it was kind of funny. It's a transparent fish on some graph paper. And there are a number of fish species and eel species that have worked very hard to become transparent. And some of them have gone so far as to abandon blood as we know it. One of the defining features of the vertebrate lineage is our red blood cells, our hemoglobin that we use to transport oxygen. And there are species of ice fish that have abandoned hemoglobin, abandoned red blood cells in their effort to become transparent. And they've gone that far. They've abandoned blood. But if you notice, there's one part of this animal that is not transparent, and that's the central nervous system. And so here's, you can see right through the animal all the way up here, but you can't see through the brain, of course the retina, part of the central nervous system. But look at that, it's abandoned, these animals can abandon hemoglobin, but they can't make their brain transparent. And why is that? Well, it's because largely of scattering. Photons that hit an interface of lipid and water, fat and water, will scatter. They'll go off in a different direction. And so you won't get light penetrating through. And that is in many ways a fundamental challenge in neuroscience today. How do we deal with scattering, see deep into the brain? And that's why you have to cut brains into very thin sections in order to get any deep structural information on them. You just can't see through them. Well, what we've worked on is ways to overcome that. And this is the Clarity method, where you can take a mouse brain here over some text, and you can actually make that brain transparent. So you can read text through it. And it's not only transparent to photons, but you can actually get protein labels and antibodies that will effectively paint in different colors different kinds of cells. So you can actually see what cell type do we have, what's around it, what kinds of cells are near it, and what kinds of proteins are expressed. And that will really move us, like reading a circuit diagram would, toward a deeper understanding of how neural circuitry works. And this method we call Clarity. And it works by removing the fat, removing the lipids, and thereby addressing the core scattering issue. Now, that sounds simple. It's not, because the lipids are a crucial part of the brain. They have embedded within them many of the key proteins, the structural features. In many ways, the structure of the brain is the structure of its boundaries. And that's because of the electrical properties of the brain. Electrical current is sent from one brain area to another. It's got to maintain its identity as it's going over long distances. And so there's a great deal of insulation of lipids in the brain and lipid-water interfaces. And that's why you can't make a brain transparent. It's the scattering that's almost intrinsic to how brains operate. But with Clarity, what we can do, and this is a part of a mouse brain. It was never sliced, but imaged intact. These are neurons. Each of the little green circles is a neuron. And the long tendrils are connections, axons and dendrites that link one kind of cell to another. And I'll give you some orientation. This is a brain area called the hippocampus, and we're flying over one brain region and now looking up into another, the surface part of the brain, the cortex. And you can see a forest of dendrites coming up from these cells going to the surface of the brain and the cell bodies of the neurons living here. And this we were able to achieve by figuring out a way to, in a non-destructive way, a non-damaging way, remove the lipids and allow transparency to happen. And we can introduce labels as well. So this is a part of the mouse hippocampus. Each of these little circles that you see here is a different cell, but they're different colors. And each of the colors is a label of a different kind of cell. And one way we can label kinds of cells is through antibody staining. Antibodies are a normal part of the immune system, but you can make them bind to particular kinds of targets that are present in some cells but not other cells, label them with fluorescent markers, and send them in to tissue. But you can't send them in unless the lipids have been removed, because they'll just hit the lipid barrier and stop. So removing the lipids does two things. It lets us address the scattering issue and make the brain transparent, and it lets us get in these antibody labels that allow us to see the kind of cell that we have. And that's advantageous because we can even work with human clinical brain samples, make them transparent as well using Clarity. This is a sample from a human brain bank, people who very generously, or families who donate brain tissue. This is a very, very valuable, precious resource, and you want to get as much information as you can from it. And we can do antibody staining for connections. Here, the tendrils you see are for axons that go from one part of the human cortex to another. And we can look at those and assess their wiring. We can even see certain kinds of abnormalities in a human brain sample. This is from an individual with autism who died, and the generous donation of the brain allowed us to then carry out a more detailed investigation. And we saw, you know, there's a neuron labeled in green here and a neuron labeled in blue. And we saw unusual features that clarity helped us be confident of. Connections, ladder-like connections, which are not normally seen, connecting even one cell to itself or one cell to a neighbor. And I'll show you this reconstruction back and forth. The green and blue label is a sort of a skeletonized, analyzed version of it that helps you see the ladder-like structures. But we can peel that away and show you the underlying label, which is in red. And the underlying label in red shows you these ladder-like structures, which you don't normally expect to see a neuron connecting with itself, or even a neuron connecting with a nearby neuron in that ladder-like fashion. And so this sort of structural abnormality would be very hard to see and be confident of without clarity, without the ability to have everything intact and see, oh, that really was a dendrite coming from the same cell, and we have this sequence of ladder-like connections. And we don't yet know the significance or how common this sort of thing might be, or even the statistical significance of its association. It's simply an observation, but it has interesting, perhaps relevance to other things that are seen, including in autism. There are proteins called protocadherins that normally play a role in this sort of self-avoidance. You normally don't have a neuron connecting to itself. And some of these genes are linked to autism spectrum disorders in human beings. Now, that structural thing, that structural aspect of clarity is exciting because we can then see brain-wide without slicing connections and even see their type. But one final missing piece I want to share with you is actually then seeing activity along those projections in the intact brain. And that was not possible even until this year. And so we talked about the opportunity of controlling, using optogenetics, controlling dynamics along highways in the brain. But what if you could observe the patterns of activity that were normally there? That would add immensely to understanding. You would see the native patterns of activity, and then that could serve as a guide and a way to more powerfully interpret the control, optogenetic control experiments. And we do this now with a method we call fiber photometry, which allows one to even deepen the brain to observe the time-varying traffic along a connection. And from the point of view of the animal, it looks the same as optogenetics. It's just a fiber optic implanted in the brain. But what we do, there's some optics that lets us pick up a fluorescent signal that reports on the electrical activity of cells deep in the brain. Now, other groups, including in Japan and at Genelia Farm, two separate locations, have been working on making fluorescent reporters of activity. And these are very clever tools called GCAMPs. You'll see that here, GCAMP, GCAMP. All these do is they change their fluorescence. These are proteins that change how they fluoresce when neurons are very active, and they sense elevated calcium levels in cells, which go up when cells are active. And these are wonderful tools, and we were able to then hook those tools made by others up to some optics on our end and the optogenetic apparatus and all those tests that we validated. And we can now listen in on activity deep in the brain, not just in cells, but in connections that go from one part of the brain to another. Here's a test of sucrose consumption. Everybody likes sweet things. Mice like sweet things. It's rewarding to them. It's motivating to them. And so what if we go back to this ventral tegmental area where the dopamine neurons live that we've talked about before, where we think some motivated and even drug of abuse related behavior might be relevant to. And what if we listen in, or what if we watch those neurons during licking of a spout for sucrose? What happens? And so we have what we call, and other people call, a lickometer, which lets us pick up every lick the animal makes on the spout. And so a red dash indicates the licking is happening. And if you just have a regular old fluorescent protein, a yellow fluorescent protein, not a GCAMP, not supposed to respond to activity, and this was good, you see absolutely nothing. So there's not an artifact of some kind caused by motion or the fiber bending or something. But if you've put one of these reporters of activity into the brain, these GCAMPs, now you see these dopamine neurons being active more or less exactly when the licking is happening. It habituates a little bit. We all know we get used to good things after a while, and that's maybe not a complete surprise. But we can actually observe the activity of these cells deep in the brain in real time during behavior. And not only in the cell bodies, and this is a very talented group of people who did this work, this must be just sugar water here. I don't know what it is, but this is the group, the two in the middle, Logan Groznick and Isaac Kalvar, worked on the fiber photometry side. Joel Finkelstein and Lisa Gneiden, very talented optogenetics and behaviorists, great friends. They all worked together. And what they were able to find was that they could actually see traffic along the connection from those dopamine neurons in the ventral tegmental area to the nucleus accumbens, the structure that we've talked about a couple times already. And they could see this in a variety of different rewarding, motivating, what we say, appetitive tasks, including social behavior. Mice, like it seems, at least they act as if they're positively motivated by interacting with each other, even in settings that are not linked to obvious immediate reward, not in mating or territory-related situations. You can have same-sex, same-species animals in the cage, and they will tend to spend more time with each other, and that can be shown to be a positive conditioning thing. And this, of course, coming back and thinking about autism is relevant to thinking about social behavior. We don't know, of course, and it's probably not the case that mice are social for the same reasons we're social, but they are. You have to recognize they are social in that sense. They recognize that there is another individual, and they're positively motivated, and they engage in very complex approach and investigational behaviors. So with due deference to the fact these are very different species, you can observe and quantify social behavior in mice as well. And it's motivating, and we can see along this projection, along this connection, from one deep brain structure, the ventral tegmental area, to another, we can observe the activity along that projection during a social behavior, and it's a kind of activity that doesn't show up with an investigation of an object. I'm going to show you two movies that show this. And this is time-varying activity along this connection. The top movie is the social interaction movie. The bottom is just a novel object. I think it's a golf ball. So the red bar at the left is the dopamine neuron activity, and you can see that big spike, and then they separate a little bit, it drops. They come back together, engage in this active investigation, another big elevation. Never gets that big in the novel object, even though the animal seems motivated to approach it, explore it. So we can see very striking and statistically significant differences in the dopamine activity, the time-varying traffic along a deep brain projection, and that'll help us understand how the animals normally use these projections and connections in the brain. Although I won't show it to you here, we then in the same paper went and used optogenetics to control that projection, and we found that driving that enhanced social behavior, inhibiting it, decreased social behavior. And that was all not seen for the object. It was only for the social case. So this kind of thing lets us bring observation and control together in the same sort of setting and come to a deeper understanding of how neural circuitry really is causing and is used to cause complex behaviors that are relevant to psychiatric disease. You can observe activity in other ways, too. It doesn't have to be all fluorescence. Electrodes are still pretty good. We use them a lot. A lot of people do. I think we always will. They're fast. They're convenient. They don't give you much cell type information. But the nice thing about them is they map onto what we use clinically. So you've all heard of electroencephalography, EEG. And there you're using effectively surface electrodes to observe brain waves, oscillations that happen. And one thing people had noticed in social dysfunction, certainly in autism and also actually in schizophrenia, that in many of these patients, using an EEG, that there's at rest, there's a higher intensity oscillation, particularly in the front part of the brain, called a gamma oscillation. It's about 40 times per second, 40 to 80 times per second, and it reflects a synchronized activity of many cells that are oscillating together. And it's higher in these disease states that are linked to social dysfunction. And we were able to come in and test that also, and we carried out a test. We shifted the balance of activity in prefrontal cortex in a way that we thought might impair social interaction. And indeed it did. It affected social exploration, but not the novel object case. And then this was the really nice thing. We used an electrode to listen in to see if we would see something that was at least related to what was seen in the clinic. And we could see where we expected it to be when we were recording from the site where we were carrying out this intervention. We could see this oscillation, this gamma oscillation occurring, and you could see this sort of regularity to that waviness that seemed where we expected it to be, but not in a different brain region. And you can quantify this. You can see this sort of 80 hertz oscillation that appeared when we turned on an opsin and disappeared when we turned off the opsin. And this kind of thing, and I'll show you these movies as well, show that we can actually carry out and track using electrical measures of readouts changes in social behavior relevant neural circuitry. On the left is a normal situation. On the right is one of these abnormal cases. And it looks pretty similar for the first few seconds. But then in the abnormal case, you can see the juvenile animal sort of wanders off and is not pursued by the test animal. The test animal seems equally interested in the side of the cage. Whereas in the normal case, with us not having done this, there's this very prolonged period of exploration. I mean, the juvenile can't really get away. It's of such interest to the animal that we're testing. And in fact, in the abnormal case, it's the juvenile that comes around and reinvestigates the test animal. And so very different social behavior, and all carried out with a very precise optogenetic intervention, and it gives this brainwave pattern that is also, in some cases, not all cases, seen in autism. So this is a sort of opportunity to now start to bend the arc back to the clinic and see, well, what can we see in the animal models that matches up back to what we've seen in the clinical case. And I'll just share one more thing before we close, which is coming back and thinking about this anecdote about the patient again. And again, with all clarity that we're a long way from understanding autism for certain, or even its individual symptom domains, and there's a great deal of work ahead of us. But if you think about this informational overload as expressed by the patient, we actually were able to come in and see that under conditions like this, where you've got abnormal social behavior in the animals, you can actually quantify that there is an informational overload in the prefrontal cortex cells. In bits per second, which you can use information theory measures to quantify, under those conditions, the cells in prefrontal cortex can't keep up with high spike rates, and they saturate and can't maintain high throughputs of information in bits per second. And this is something we were able to show back in 2011, really illustrating that there is a potential information theoretic correlate to this symptom that is experienced by the patient, and it's borne out in the animals in terms of real social behavior dysfunction. Now, we have a long way to go. We don't know that what one patient is experiencing is experienced by many. We don't understand, certainly, that there is a corresponding informational overload in patients. But this reflects the excitement that many of us in the field are starting to feel as we can start to bring engineering principles to bear. New techniques, new opportunities from neuroscience, bring in investigators, engineers, physicists from different disciplines, and start to speak a different language, a new language about neuroscience and psychiatry. Now, many people are interested in brain initiatives around the country. The Europe has one. There's obviously Japan, China. The U.S. Brain Initiative effort had its seed in a small workshop that was a confluence of nanoscientists and neuroscientists that got together and said, what sort of opportunity can we have here? And initially, the idea was, let's build new technologies to map activity in neural circuitry. We know it's a huge challenge, but we're going to start with technology. And then that morphed into what became the U.S. Brain Initiative, which just became available online just a few months ago. It's a very long document. I don't necessarily recommend reading it, but I'll give you a one-sentence summary, which is that at the U.S. level, what we're going to do is put forth an effort over 10 to 12 years of first building technologies, new technologies, and then applying them in behaving animals and linking those up to the human and clinical case when we can. And this, of course, you know, there's obviously wonderful national scale efforts going on in Canada as well. Every country seems to be doing it a little differently, and I think there's value in that diversity, leveraging native strengths. You know, the great strength in China is the some of the native monkey populations they have, and in Japan they have special ways of making primates transgenic. I think in the U.S., the emphasis on technology links up well with some of the natural strengths that are there, and Europe has a still evolving, I think, structure, but it's heavily focused on information technology at the moment. And I think, obviously, here in Canada, given the giants in the field that have been here and the wonderful tradition and ongoing tradition here, there's an immense opportunity here as well. We're trying to do our part to help with education and outreach. Some of these techniques, they're not obvious. If you haven't done them before, it's easy to go wrong. And so we host little workshops where people can come and learn how to do things in the lab. And this was very similar to optogenetics. One thing that helped optogenetics get going so quickly was actually getting these workshops going in our laboratory, and people would come and visit and actually go back to their home institutions, and that contributed to some of the excitement back in 2010. But now we're doing this with Clarity and fiberphotometry, people coming and learning these techniques. And we have websites also, if any of you are interested, for Clarity and also for optogenetics. Now, that's basically it. There are people who are applying Clarity to Alzheimer's brains and to questions of immune dysfunction in the central nervous system, questions of pain, and I think we've just begun to scratch the surface. You know, we have, I think a key principle is bringing all these optical tools together, making sure they're mutually compatible so we can see activity, so we can control activity, and so we can see structure all at the same time. We've got a fantastic group of people. I've mentioned most of the key names along the way. I just want to show you their names and pictures here. I'm indebted and honored to work with them. And I have many great collaborators here. And I look forward to talking more, hearing questions. And thank you for your time and for the honor of being here. Thank you.
How are you, Carl? Beautiful talk. So I've been a big fan of optogenetics for a long time, and I have one question about reports where the reports are inconsistent with the techniques of the previous kind of generation to test causality. So usually the systems identified by optogenetics resolve and are consistent with the systems identified by, say, inactivation approaches. But sometimes there have been disconnects between the results of inactivation, for example, and optogenetics. So is it a problem in terms of how we are inactivating the brain, or is it a problem with how we are activating certain systems in the brain?
Yeah, so we published probably one of the most prominent examples of that. And this, so the question is, you know, sometimes in some cases the results are similar to what you expect. In some cases, new insights arrive that you could not necessarily have predicted, and sometimes there's an apparent contradiction. That's rarer, but we were able to usually understand that. One thing we found when we did a very transient optogenetic inactivation of the hippocampus, we saw different results than people who had done more long-lasting lesions or pharmacological inhibition had seen. And we wondered about that, and one test we did was say, well, maybe it has to do with the timing. Maybe with the long-lasting effects of pharmacology, even, you know, tens of minutes, or certainly the much longer-lasting effects of lesions, maybe there's some compensation that happens, some adaptations that happen, and with a much faster on and off of optogenetics, you would not see that. And so we tested that by lengthening the optogenetic inhibition, and then when we did that, we saw results similar to what the more chronic traditional methods might be. And so I think, and we published that in 2011 in a paper on memory and cell. I think that need not be the only explanation, but it's an example of the kind of experiment you actually can do without genetics. You have access to these short timescales as well as longer.
Yes.
You've given us insight into neuronal activity of abnormal cases. I have a somewhat different question, and that is, given the complexity of the human brain, how do you explain the frequent incidence of dysfunctional behavior among so-called healthy people?
Well, give me an example.
I'm sure
Tell me
you can
more.
Think of lots of examples when a so-called healthy person may commit a criminal act, for example, or otherwise, assumingly, they're respectable members of society, etc. But, or for some reason or other, people who, you know, drive stupidly or et cetera, et cetera. In other words, how do you explain the fact that there is this deviance from the so-called normal in so-called healthy people? I mean, it's fine to deal with disease and try to improve the human condition, but it seems to me that a problem that is being neglected is all the irrational behavior of so-called normal people.
I think that's a great question. It's a deep one. You know, there are, everything is statistical to some extent. I think it is really true to some extent that there are in the brain, there are different structures competing for a voice, competing for output, striving for control over a third or a fourth brain region. And I think in typical or healthy people, there is a balance where some of what we might be the maladaptive patterns are suppressed. But I think it is dynamical. Nothing is fixed, and I think there are moments where the balance can shift. This is pure speculation, but I think we actually have, in some ways now, the tools to test this. We can, even in an animal that has a relatively stable adaptive pattern of activity, we could carry out more subtle shifts, transient shifts in the balance of influence in the town hall of the brain among the different voices, and see if maladaptive behaviors can arise from those transient dynamical shifts. It's one possibility. Another possibility is that there's something more purely stochastic, and these are things we would love to explore. But I don't think I can say anything definitive right now. I share your interest in that question.
Thank you.
Any other questions for over here?
Yeah, question is the microbiome, what possible effect might that have on autism? There's certainly something that's widely discussed, and increasingly so, and viewing that as its own organ in some ways that affects everything else in the body. There's no question that a number of developmental disorders can predispose to autism, and to the extent that, and also early postnatal insults can likely contribute as part of that sort of developmental continuum. It's not as if development stops, of course, at birth. And so I think it's plausible that anything that is sufficiently disruptive to the brain, which could include certain kinds of microbiome disruptions, have the potential to cause developmental abnormalities of the kind that can contribute to autism spectrum disorders. And that's about all I could say right now. It's I know that the data themselves are controversial, but again, that's something also now potentially testable in animal models. We can exert in our experimental subjects interventions like that, and look for behavioral changes. I think it's obviously a rapidly expanding field, and I think we can contribute to it. Question is, can you have other opsins that are responsive to non-visible parts of the spectrum, and particularly bands that might be easily targetable, deep targeting? We know we can do, actually, you know, there are various kinds of deep targeting that are done, ionizing radiation for sure, ultrasound, you can do some forms of depth targeting. And using those principles, you could imagine sufficiently deep penetrating light, you could generate a deep point where a greater amount of light is concentrated than at any more superficial location. The opsins themselves, though, nature has really evolved things that are in or very close to the visible spectrum. Retinal cannot physically respond to wavelengths much longer than about 760 or 780 nanometers. They do go into the UV a little bit on the other end. They will be drivable by 360 or even 350 nanometer UV light. But to my knowledge, there has not been, nature has not evolved what we know of as a single component receptor for parts of the spectrum that are that far as the ones you're talking about and that regulate ion flow. But I think the bigger concept of using light coming from different directions and trying to accumulate a depth concentration is possible. Scattering is a big issue with that, but it's potentially overcomable, at least in part.
Okay, one last question.
Yeah, it's a great question. The question is drug design. Does this causal control, or does the observation, particularly with fiber photometry, does that let us or help us in design of new drugs? I think there's this huge potential, unrealized, and I have no reason to say that this is more likely to work than anything else, but of circuit-targeted therapeutics in some way, instead of looking for drugs that bind to a receptor, looking for drugs that modulate traffic along a well-defined projection in some way, that's a really potentially exciting opportunity. And so you can imagine screens for drugs, not necessarily high throughput, but still could be done in animals with a deep observation of activity along a structure. You know, that at the very least, just because it's different, I think there's value in pursuing that. You're probably going to come up with different families of agents because of that. But I'm not an expert in that sort of thing, so I don't really know. But I think different is better in psychiatry at this point. You know, we've kind of run to the end of these current families of drugs in terms of greater efficacy and reduced side effects.
All right, well, I'm supposed to quickly sum up what we've heard today and quickly sum up, I think that he's shown you, that Dr. Desiraj has shown very nicely how new technology, which always drives science, and these two new technologies of optogenetics and hopefully in the future the clarity technique, would really allow us to gain new insights into how the brain works. And in particular, the optogenetics have given us really new insights into the specificity of circuitry have given us the ability to change that circuitry and figure out what it does. And I think that will, in the future, have big effects on not only our understanding of the brain, but obviously understanding then leads down the line to the ability to manipulate and to change it. And I think the final thing we have today is a thank you to Dr. Deseroth, and we have David Rechtigel, who's the VP for the McGill Alumni Fund, and a alumni of McGill, an MBA in 1987, I believe, who is here to give a parting gift.
So thank you, Dr. Sosin. Yes, I'm a Vice President of the McGill Alumni Association, just to be Board of Directors. I'd like to thank, take this opportunity to thank the BD Committee and the Homecoming Committee for their continued commitment to this important event. McGill's Homecoming celebrations are a wonderful opportunity to connect with friends, old and new, and we thank you for making the BD Memorial Lecture a part of your programming. We're also extremely grateful for the support of the team at the Montreal Neurological Institute and Hospital for hosting Professor Deseroth and for their assistance in making this event happen. It's now my great privilege to present Professor Deseroth with a token of our appreciation. Where'd he go?
Thank you, Mr. Rechtigel. Thank you also, Dr. Wayne Sosin, who was not introduced, Professor of Medicine at the Montreal Neurological Institute and one of the hosts for our visitors. So thank you for managing the questions and answers professionally. Also, thank you to Professor Fortier for your introduction of our speaker. And I really just want to thank all of you for coming out tonight, students, alumni, community members, McGill community, and thank you for spending some of your homecoming and some of your evening with us. I want to thank Professor Deseroth, of course, again, for your wonderful lecture. And thank you also for spending your time, your career, and your intellect on such an important topic of mental health and trying to really understand it better. I know that so many in our population and worldwide suffer from these diseases, and your efforts are very important and very much appreciated. So thank you. Bonne soirée, and have a good evening. Thank you.